Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellant, Commonwealth of Virginia. This case presents the question of whether the ends of justice exception should be applied and under what circumstances. And the issue in this case is one of notice versus a void judgment. And I would argue that the Court of Appeals confused those issues because this case involved an issue of notice, not an issue of void judgment.
Before you get too far down the road, would you tell me what our standard of review is when we are reviewing the Court of Appeals decision under Rule 5A18? Is that an error of law question, or does that have any discretion, abuse of discretion standard? Nobody's addressed that, and I'm interested to know.
I believe it's an error of law because the question of whether the ends of justice exception should be applied is a question of law, I would argue.
Well, you have to take a lot of facts into consideration, don't you?
Well, I mean, certainly if they've made factual determinations, we look at what the trial court's factual determinations are, I think, here. But I would argue the facts here do not support that finding.
Well, I know you're going to have a lot of time to make that argument, too. What I want to know is what's the target? Is this an abuse of discretion standard for us, or is this an error of law?
I believe it's an error of law.
Nobody's addressed it, and the other side needs to be prepared to answer that as well. Go ahead.
With regard to, back to the issue of the confusion about whether this is an issue of notice or void judgment. In Henson, this case, there was no objection. And this court held that issue was waived. And the reason was because it was exactly the same situation here. There was a charge of attempted robbery, and there was a conviction of robbery. And the court found that that was a waivable objection. And so there is no reason to distinguish the Henson case based on the ends of justice exception here. If an issue is waivable, it's waivable. And it was certainly waivable here. There was no objection. And, in fact, the evidence shows, I would argue, that the defendant here had notice of what the charge was in this case because all of the evidence showed that he, in fact, committed a robbery. There was a jury instruction for robbery, which he did not object to. And so for those reasons, in fact, there was some confusion about an attempted robbery with another victim. And it's obvious from the record, especially given the fact that the warrant in this case originally charged a robbery against this particular victim.
Your position is that though he was mischarged, if you will, the evidence demonstrated he committed a robbery. And as a result, the guilty verdict and the conviction on that can't possibly be a miscarriage of justice.
Exactly, because, in fact, the reason for an indictment, which is a matter of statute, not a constitutional issue, is to give notice to the defendant. And here he had notice. He had notice both because of the warrant, because of the evidence, and because of the jury instruction. And so there is no miscarriage of justice that took place here. To apply the ends of justice...
Is the punishment any different for attempted robbery versus robbery?
Yes.
Right. And was he punished in excess of the maximum for which he was charged?
I know he was sentenced for a robbery, but he was also convicted of a robbery. So he was not, the conviction was for a robbery, not for an attempted robbery. That's why this case is not like Ferguson or like Leggett. It is distinguishable. Those cases involve an excess of the sentence where there's a conviction that differs from what he is sentenced for.
Basically what the Court of Appeals opinion did is to conflate for fatal variance purposes the predicate of the conviction with the amended indictment.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
And correct me if I'm wrong, we have Court of Appeals published opinions saying fatal variances are not voiding concepts and can clearly be waived.
Absolutely. And we've cited those cases on brief. But in addition, this court has clearly found that it can be waived in Henson.
Right.
The exact same situation here where there was a greater conviction than what was initially charged. So it can't be that just because it was a stiffer offense, if you will, that there has to be a miscarriage of justice. And the ends of justice should be applied not just when there is error, but when there is...
Ms. Bourne, what do we make of, or what do you make of the language in Henson where this court draws a distinction between Henson and Hayes, and it says that we pointed out in Hayes that a conviction could be attacked on direct appeal because of the variance between the indictment and the verdict. We had in mind an appeal to correct an error by the trial court, and specifically pointed out that in Henson there was no error by the trial court. But in here there seemed to be error by the trial court, the defense attorney, and the Commonwealth's attorney.
But that doesn't eviscerate the contemporaneous objection rule. And the issue in that case was whether you could raise it on habeas for the first time. And the court, of course, in Hayes, was talking about whether you can raise it as a collateral attack. And so one of the most important issues is whether that was waived and whether this was the appropriate mechanism to do it. Yes, you can raise it on direct appeal, but only if you've preserved that below. And I would note that one of the cases that is cited in dealing with the issue of what happens when this if this goes back has to do with a waiver. And the point is specifically made, well, there was an objection here. And so because of this, we would argue that there was no grave injustice here. This was not a case in which an element did not occur, as in Ali. This was not a case of a void sentence, as in Charles. This was not a conviction for a non-offense, as in Jimenez. And so none of the situations which involved not just an error, but a grave injustice occur here. This, in fact, was a run-of-the-mill fatal variance case. Was it error? Would it have been error? Yes. But...
Well, had there been an objection,
there would have been
a motion to amend the indictment, and there had been zero prejudice proffered, and the indictment would have been amended.
And why should the defendant here get a windfall for his failure to object by essentially getting a greater remedy than he would have been entitled to had he objected at trial?
Well, that was the second error of the Court of Appeals, is that they inaccurately believed that the remand was on the lesser charge. Even in a fatal variance case, the remand is completely open. There's no double jeopardy attachment at all.
That's right, because as the Court of Appeals pointed out in Kirby and under 19.2293, there is a statutory remedy for what happens when there's a fatal variance. And what happens is it goes back for a retrial. It is not double jeopardy under those circumstances. So for that reason, the second issue was also, their second finding was also incorrect.
Ms. Bourne, there's another error, I think, in the Court of Appeals opinion that hasn't been addressed by, I think, either one of you, but we're going to have to address it, I think. Court of Appeals says, in light of our conclusion that appellant's robbery conviction must be reversed, we need not consider the question of whether the evidence was sufficient to sustain the conviction. That has to be wrong. If the evidence is not sufficient, the defendant doesn't get retried.
That's correct.
Well, then you here, I think, need to address that question, even though they didn't.
Well, and I think on brief we did argue that the evidence was sufficient to convict. And I argued that in fact is an assignment of error, that they erred by refusing to reach that issue. And the issue here is that the argument made for the sufficiency of the evidence, the only argument that they made at trial, had to do with, and on appeal, had to do with whether or not the testimony was incredible as a matter of law.
But in this case, there was no motion to strike based upon sufficiency, and consequently there is no preservation of the question.
That's exactly right. So, and for the reasons argued on brief, that they didn't reach my argument as to the sufficiency of the evidence, but we did argue that that argument was not preserved, because that differs, that issue differs from, I'm just saying the evidence is insufficient. When you argue that the evidence is incredible as a matter of law, that's a very rare circumstance and has to be something beyond just a mere argument that the evidence was sufficient to convict. And unless the court has further questions for me, I would just ask that you...
See, you're in a very a different position. You actually get to reserve some time now.
And I did forget to do that, but I would just ask for my remaining time for rebuttal.
Just remember, you go to that table.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Joan Burrows. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Bass, the appellee in this matter, and we are asking the court certainly to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case. The Commonwealth spends a lot of time talking about why Henson does not apply in this case, and I think that's incorrect, but that's a very important difference. The Henson case there, the trial court specifically pointed out that there was an issue between what the defendant was charged with, what he was convicted of, and what he was about to be sentenced on. The issue there was in front of the trial court. It was presented to defense counsel. Defense counsel affirmatively decided not to address it, and that's what sets us apart from Henson.
Okay, counsel, let's go with the Commonwealth's argument that the trial attorney should have noticed that there was a variance between the indictment and the conviction. And should the failure to notice that be rewarded when the defendant was not prejudiced?
I don't think that... I have a hard time qualifying this as a reward situation. The defendant was put on notice through the indictment that he was being charged with attempted robbery. I understand the Commonwealth relies on the warrant that was issued in this situation, but quite frankly, I think it's reasonable to assume that...
The defendant was indicted for both attempted robbery and robbery. The only issue was a confusion as to who the victims were, correct?
Certainly, but I think with regards to, especially when you're dealing with inchoate offenses such as this, there's a big difference between being charged with the robbery of individual A as opposed to being charged with attempted robbery of individual B, and that's the issue that we have here. He's indicted and told that he's being charged with attempted robbery of individual B and then turns around and is convicted of completed robbery.
But if there had been an objection, what would have happened is the obvious clerical error would have been corrected, and the warrant would have clearly identified that he was on notice of the true charge, and the trial judge would have amended the indictment. So there is a reward. If he said something at trial, "I object to this," then he would have probably ended up with an amended indictment or some other process. But he said nothing. He didn't object to the jury instruction. He gets convicted. And let's say, for the sake of argument, the sufficiency is a non-starter. Under the Court of Appeals opinion, he gets a double jeopardy win on robbery, which at several levels causes me to rethink this case.
My response to that is this case is rife with errors. Certainly this is an issue that should have been caught by defense counsel, but it's also an issue that should have been caught by the Commonwealth. And to saddle Mr. Bass with a robbery conviction when the Commonwealth was not held to its burden is unconscionable to me.
Well, the Commonwealth was held to its burden. It has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt he was convicted of a charge of robbery, and he was guilty of a charge of robbery. He was.
He was charged with attempted robbery. The Commonwealth did not fix that amendment. The Commonwealth did not amend the indictment, and therefore they were held to that standard. And so to find him guilty of something different than that, something much more serious than attempted robbery, is an error on the part of the Commonwealth. The Mr. Bass's life and liberty is at stake. The Commonwealth.
But that's what waivers do. Waivers don't waive non-errors. If the argument is, we hear it all the time, heard it for 15 years, I have a winning argument, therefore I can't have waiver. Because ends of justice is a winning argument should win. If that were true, then the only thing you could ever waive under 525 or 518 are losing arguments, which means waiver is illusory. It doesn't exist. You can only waive losing arguments. You see the flaw in the logic in that?
My concern would be if this is allowed to stand, then what constitutes an ends of justice action?
Well, let me ask you this. Was he sentenced in excess of the statutory maximum for either robbery or attempted robbery?
He was sentenced to 10 years on what was a robbery at that point. And certainly the maximum for an attempted robbery is 10 years. but okay. I don't think...
So the answer is no, he wasn't sentenced in excess.
He's not sentenced in excess of it, but the issue here is that it should have been a 10th. The jury should have been instructed that he could be sentenced between 1 and 5 years. Not in, when being sentenced on the robbery, as Your Honor knows, I mean, you start at 5 years. And I think the fact that the jury didn't give him the maximum punishment, actually gave him something quite close to the minimum punishment, that speaks to the fact that this, there is an issue with the sentence as well. So I think the fact that he's not sentenced to more than 10 years is not something the Commonwealth should be able to hang their hat on.
To me, the formalism of attempt versus actual robbery is less a problem of manifest injustice than someone being sentenced inappropriately, as some of the earlier cases indicate.
In response to that, I think the problem here and the problem that I have as a defense attorney is that if this case is allowed to stand, then the Commonwealth is allowed to come in, indict for the lowest amount, the lowest possible offense, and proceed to trial on anything higher than that. And as a defense attorney, that's unconscionable.
But isn't the answer, though, I mean, there's a panoply of remedies available. One of them is ends of justice on direct appeal. And concurrently with that is a habeas petition, and then there's other remedies as well. So why do we have to park this under ends of justice as opposed to habeas or something else?
And can I say something else? Why wouldn't you just object at trial? Because if it's they're putting on evidence different from what's in the indictment, the evidence is irrelevant. You just say the evidence didn't come in because it's irrelevant, John.
But I think in a situation, for example, where you've got a type of malicious wounding, for instance, if the defendant's charged with assault and battery, or a felonious assault and battery, then certainly evidence that would be admissible to prove malicious wounding or aggravated malicious wounding would certainly still be relevant to an assault, a felonious assault and battery case. So that still leaves us with the issue that they're allowed, that if this is allowed to stand, the Commonwealth can start.
But don't you have other opportunities to object when your client has an indictment for unlawful wounding and he's arraigned on a malicious wounding? Object, Your Honor. When your client is charged on an indictment with unlawful wounding and he's found guilty of malicious wounding, object, Your Honor. So you have opportunities to correct the error, and if you don't, and so then we roll back into Justice Kelsey's position of the only time you would ever apply ends of justice is if there was no good argument. Do you see the problem that we're having?
I do, and perhaps I'm not stating this as clearly as I should and as I can. I think the issue is, to me, if this is affirmed, then what we're saying is that the indictments doesn't necessarily matter as much as we thought they did.
No, perhaps no. What we're no. saying as defense counsel, you should object, or you waive it.
I certainly think that this, yes, it should have been objected to.
Counsel, what I hear you arguing, I think, is that we're going to be heading down a slippery slope. Now, you are positing back to us what will happen when there is a single victim and a single crime, and you are indicted for assault and battery, and then you are convicted of malicious wounding. I think that under those circumstances, there easily could be an ends of justice exception argument made. That's not your case, though. And we have to look at your case first. In your case, multiple victims, multiple crimes, indicted for both attempted robbery and robbery. And the only problem, and then the proof is made, the proof is sufficient beyond a reasonable doubt, and the sentence is within the limits that the robbery charge permits. The only problem is there's two victims named Smith, and the two names are juxtaposed. Where is the injustice under those circumstances? Not a case that could be distinguished 5 years, 10 years from now. Where is the injustice there?
The injustice is that the outcome did not match the indictment. Defense counsel proceeded under the understanding, and rightfully so, of what the indictment stated. Certainly there could have been an amendment to the indictment, but that was not done. And so the injustice here is that He's charged with a lower class felony and found guilty of a higher class felony. I understand there may have been an error, and we're certainly not alleging that the Commonwealth did this on purpose or maliciously. The fact of the matter is, when the Commonwealth is charged with dealing with somebody's life and liberty, they're expected to do better. And certainly defense counsel in this case could have done better as well. But that's why we have the ends of justice exception. That's
but it seems like to me, doesn't it, the bottom line, it comes down to the Commonwealth not amending the indictment. I mean, isn't that what your problem is with this whole case? I mean, at some point the evidence comes in, which in this instance it seems like there was sufficient evidence to prove that the defendant was guilty of a particular crime, and they didn't amend the indictment to match the evidence that they had put on.
Certainly, I think if there had been an amendment, we would not be here, and we would certainly be in a much...
And do you know of any reason why our court would not grant such an amendment if it were asked for?
I cannot think of one.
So what's the prejudice to your client?
I think it falls to the fact that, again, the onus is on the Commonwealth to make the correction. The Commonwealth made an error, and that error cannot be held to Mr. Bass and cannot be taken out against Mr. Bass because that's what he was charged with.
How would he have tried it differently? How would it have been tried differently if there had not been what appears to be what I would call a technical error with regard to the indictment? Technical in this particular fact pattern. It would not have been technical in a different fact pattern. How would it have been tried differently?
I certainly can't get into the mind of the trial attorney and how he would have approached it, but I think the fact that a robbery is different from an attempted robbery certainly opens the door, even in cases where both are charged, to different approaches. And since this was an issue between which victim was which is apparently that seems to be the error here, and the confusion on the part of the trial court, the Commonwealth, and the defense attorney, the fact that they're different offenses is what, to me, carries the day here. Again, the Commonwealth took out an indictment for attempted robbery. That's not what they are held to.
But let me interrupt you. Think through the game theory of the opposite argument. You're saying, imagine what will happen, Your Honors, if we don't hold ends of justice. Well, I ask you, imagine what would happen if we did. And we're defending the guy, you and I, in the next case, after the Virginia Supreme Court says that if you convict on robbery after an attempted robbery indictment, it is void and ends of justice. You don't need to object. There won't be a habeas. Everything's good. And you and I have exactly this scenario. We're litigating it together at counsel table. And we see, wow, they're proceeding under a criminal conviction for consummated robbery. There's zero incentive to object. There's 100% incentive to not object. Because if you and I are sitting there and we're talking, I would say, don't object. Why? Because if we don't object, we get two bites at the apple. If we actually lose this argument in front of the jury, we'll get an ends of justice vacature of the robbery, and under the Court of Appeals opinion, a double jeopardy consequence. On the other hand, if we object and say, I object, you're going forward on the wrong theory, they're going to amend the indictment. How is that not going to be, for any lawyer thinking through the game theory of this, not going to be the result of the holding you're asking us to reach?
I understand the court's concern. And with that perspective, I do think it's troubling, and I still, though, it does not excuse the Commonwealth from being held to a standard, and that's what I'm asking the court to do. I don't have a good answer to that. I apologize, but it still does not excuse the fact that Mr. Bass had a right to be told what he was being charged with, and the fact that his defense counsel was not able to catch this error is problematic, and to hold him accountable to the extent that he's being found guilty of something he was not originally charged with is the problem that I'm asking this court to correct.
Okay, so he was charged with robbing Vidal Smith, correct?
Yes.
He was charged with the attempted robbery of Irving Smith, correct?
I believe yes.
Vidal testified at the trial, correct?
He did.
Irving testified at the trial, correct?
He did.
How would the proof have differed?
I think I understand that this is, the facts are what they are. And I think it is hard to approach this as the court is in this position without looking at the facts. But I think the bigger picture and what I'm hoping to emphasize, and that I think I've done multiple times much to the disagreement of the court, but the fact is the Commonwealth has to be held to their burden of what the indictment said. He was found guilty. He was found guilty of a completed crime. He's found guilty of a Category 1 life offense when that's not what he's charged with. That's the error that I'm concerned with as defense counsel and that I hope the court will be concerned with as well. The fact that in this specific case, there may not have been excess prejudice, perhaps so, but I think that the Commonwealth needs to be held to a higher burden with regard to making sure their indictments match the proof, match the outcome, match the sentence. So for that reason, I'm asking the court to affirm the holding of the Court of Appeals. And I see that my time has expired.
Thank you very much. Ms. Ward, you have 4 minutes and 35 seconds remaining if you think you need it.
I promise the court I won't use that entire time. The only thing that I would say is that there was no grave injustice here. There was no prejudice here. And one of the things I would point out is that he was charged with robbery for Irving Smith, but that was actually amended before they went to the jury. The jury instruction was amended. So he was originally charged with one robbery, well, actually two because there was a third victim, and one attempted robbery. And what went to the jury were two robberies and one attempted robbery. So here there was no prejudice. The fact that they, all three, the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense attorney, apparently failed to notice this typographical error when the last names were transposed, does not create a prejudice in this case. And as Justice Mims, you pointed out, nothing would have been done differently. And counsel should not be entitled to a windfall merely because, or something better than they would have received at trial merely because they failed to object. Because as Justice Kelsey points out, that only encourages a failure to object and to have errors corrected on appeal, not at trial where they should be corrected. And for those reasons, I would ask that you reverse.
Thank you very much. Call the next.